a civilization run amok, and he died in 1950. You can just imagine two things. You can just imagine what he would think of 2018 and the prophetic nature of this man's mind and consciousness. This referenced the idea of writing this book. So this is a 40-year process of putting this book out. Can you tell us the story about how you first heard of Jaime Dangulo?
Yeah, I think one of the things to think about him is that he was considered to have the best ear of any linguist in his active days, which was effectively the 1920s, when he worked on something like 27 Northern California, Northern Mexican languages, all of them languages that had no writing systems and had never been recorded. And he wrote up grammars and vocabulary lists for all these languages. He published a great deal in ethnographic and linguistic journals, really professional journals. He had some monographs, but he never had a book to his name. And all his books came into print much after he was, quite a while after he was dead. I think one of the reasons is that by the time of his death, he was already a figure of folklore. He was known for a friendship and sort of enmity eventually with Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst, with D.H. Lawrence, with Mabel Dodge Aluhan, with Robinson Jeffers, with Ezra Pound, with Marianne Moore, and William Carlos Williams, not to speak of all the great linguists and anthropologists of the day, like Alfred Grober, Edward Sapir, Franz Boas, who staked into quite a bit of money during the 1920s to study Indian languages. He didn't really have any books except Indian Tales, the one that came into print shortly after his death. No other books came into print until the 1970s. An outfit called Turtle Island Foundation in Berkeley, run by Bob and Eileen Callahan, published 7 little volumes of the Jaime Dangulo Library. Very beautiful little books, gorgeously bound in cloth, and each of them hand-set and printed by Graham McIntosh or Clifford Burke, two of the preeminent printers of the 1970s of the Bay Area. In about 1976, somebody put one of these in my hands. It was Angulo's Novella of the Laureate. And after reading that, I had to get all the rest. These were followed by a reader that Callahan's put out. And at some point I went back to school, to UC Berkeley, hoping to get an MA degree and in English. And Angulo had taught for a couple of summers at Berkeley in the early 20s, and then was increasingly excluded from the university because of his bohemian lifestyle. In fact, Alfred Kroeber, the founder and chair of the anthropology department, warned graduate students that it might ruin their career if they went up to Jaime Dangulo's house in the hills there. It was too wild a place. And the descriptions of the time suggest that you could drop by on a Sunday and you never knew if you were going to find a drinking party and an orgy or a very serious discussion of phonetics among the Pomo Indians or the Maidu or the Modoc or the Achimawe. The anthropologists with already established reputations like Edward Sapir and Paul Radden didn't listen to Kroeber. They could go up there and they knew he couldn't ruin their reputation. Some of the braver graduate students went up there. But I was at Berkeley in the late 70s hoping to finish a degree. I had to write a thesis for the English department. And I decided that from what I was seeing of Angulo's work, both what had been brought into print and doing archival work where his papers had been deposited at UC Santa Cruz in the McHenry Library, that I would like to write on Angulo and his wife's anthropological and linguistic work. So I knocked on the doors of 6 professors in the English department. These were all people who specialized in modern literature, except one who specialized in oral literature. 2 of them were members of the Berkeley and San Francisco Renaissance. And they all should have known better, but each of them turned down my proposition in turn. I had no idea what to do. I could go out and find the Callahans of Turtle Island, or I could go to a Sandollar bookstore run by Jack and Vicky Shoemaker, or I could go to Heyday Books and find Malcolm Margolin, and I could talk about California Bohemians, I could talk about Native California linguistics, I could talk about anthropology, I could talk about contemporary poetry, but I couldn't do that in the English department. So in a bit of despair, I went to the offices and took refuge with the department administrator. And I started out rather poorly. I said, you know, you've got a lot of very lazy faculty in this department. She bristled and said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, I need somebody to sponsor a thesis for me. And I asked six professors, and they all turned me down. One of them even said, oh, come on, Andrew, to sponsor your thesis, I'd have to read all of Jaime's work again. And she said, Jaime who? And I said, Jaime D'Angulo. And she said, of course nobody wants to sponsor a thesis on that. Nobody's heard of him. Why don't you write a thesis on William Butler Yeats? One of our faculty's already written two books on him. She and I swapped the kind of volley of words, rather harsh, and I left the university without a degree, without a thesis, thanks to Jaime D'Angulo, to become a poet instead.
Well done.
There's a story about dinner with Jeffers. Jeffers is one of the people you mentioned, and it's a great story. And if and to illustrate why the establishment might have had issues with a person like that, that story might do it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the account is, Angulo had gone to medical school. His only kind of adult life, aside from a stint in the Army during World War I, but his only real time outside of California as an adult, he went to medical school at Johns Hopkins, met a terrifically progressive woman who moved in socialist and feminist circles in the 1920s, and they moved back out to California together. Her name was Carrie Fink. She eventually, when she and Angulo divorced, she went to Zurich and studied with Carl Jung and married an American Jungian named George Baines and became the Carrie Baines, who some of you may have seen as a translator of Carl Jung's work and the famous Richard Wilhelm edition of the I Ching. But Jaime and Carrie sort of settled down in Carmel, which was a bohemian enclave that had already had some reputation for the arts, but in the wake of the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, a lot more artists moved down. There was no place to live in San Francisco. Everything was largely destroyed in the city, or what wasn't destroyed was hard to get a hold of. So Carmel had become a real bohemian center. And Carrie came from a family with some money. She built a little bungalow on the beaches down in Carmel, and she and Jaime lived there until he decided to go up to Modoc County and buy into a ranch. But while they were in Carmel, Jaime was walking along. He had two dogs, wolfhounds, big gray wolfhounds. And he must have looked remarkable with a wolfhound on each side. And he went one day down the beach and stopped into town and got a couple porterhouse steaks for dinner. And on the way back with the steaks wrapped up under his arm, he ran into an interesting couple, Robinson and Una Jeffers, and they fell into conversation, and Angulo and Jeffers immediately discovered they had a mutual love for old languages and for old literatures and etymologies and all sorts of things. And Jaime invited them home for dinner. When they got home, Carrie was washing spinach. She sort of took charge. She said to Una, you cook the potatoes, Jaime, you cook the steaks. And then she looked at the spinach she was washing and threw it out the door, saying, the vegetable's not worth the effort to clean it. Jaime roasted up the steaks on an open fire. The potatoes were nowhere done, but they did have the steaks ready. So the four sat down to eat, and Jaime's wolfhounds sat one on each side of him, and Jaime looked at his guests, and then he looked at his wolfhounds, and then he looked at his guests, back at the wolfhounds, and then he said, "A shame if they would be to go hungry." And he forked the steaks to his dogs. So this endeared him to the Jeffers. And Gary Snyder said that Jaime D'Angulo was the only man Jeffers would admit into his house day or night, which is, you know, sort of a wonderful friendship. Angulo says that when they got together, Jeffers never spoke. Angulo did all the talking. And Angulo says that he never actually read any of Jeffers' poetry. I don't think that's quite true. But it's thought that a number of the characters in Jeffers' poetry, particularly the Spanish Indian cowboy in The Loving Shepherdess, is modeled on Angulo. And there's some great descriptions that really show this sort of half Spanish, half wild man who's excellent with horses, who rides the big Sur Country.